From Cowdersport to Beaver Falls, Erie to Williamsport, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, with on-site public education shut down, how have charter and cyber charter schools fared? Anna Myers from the Pennsylvania Coalition of Public Charter Schools is here with the answer. The coronavirus lockdown dramatically reduced traffic on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi have an Allegheny Institute report on the financial impact. And state government has reduced regulations and suspended some licensure requirements for healthcare workers during the coronavirus pandemic. On this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary, Ashley Klingensmith of Americans for Prosperity PA says those changes should be made permanent. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Anna Myers in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. After vetoing three bills aimed at reopening parts of Pennsylvania's economy, including real estate sales, Governor Tom Wolf reversed course and announced that those employees involved in real estate can resume operations if they follow state health department guidelines. Wolf has been under growing grassroots and legislative pressure to move more quickly to open various segments of the state's economy. He also signed into law a provision that will allow bars and restaurants to sell cocktails to go. However, he still refuses to allow restaurants to begin seating customers, even outdoors. Wolf also has blocked the reopening of barber shops and hair salons, going so far as to threaten any which reopen with the loss of licenses and fines. Portions of South Central and Eastern Pennsylvania remain in so-called red lockdowns, and some counties in that area have rebelled, announcing they will move to yellow status on their own. The Department of Health this week finally released a detailed accounting of the number of COVID-19 cases and related deaths in nursing and personal care homes throughout the state. More than two-thirds of the deaths in the Commonwealth have occurred in such facilities. That has led to escalating calls for the resignation of State Health Secretary Rachel Levine, who in March ordered the return of hospitalized patients suffering from coronavirus back into those facilities. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. The abrupt end to the school year in response to the COVID-19 pandemic affected public charter schools and cyber charter schools, as well as the traditional public schools. For a look at how charter schools have adjusted, we turn to Anna Myers. Anna is Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Coalition of Public Charter Schools. Anna, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Anna, of course, like everything else, charter schools, be they brick-and-mortar charter schools or cyber charter schools, have all been affected by this coronavirus crisis. Can you first of all give our audience a bit of an overview as to what impact the closures have had on public charter schools?
Well, sure, Loman. Thank you for having me on the show. As it has impacted school districts and private schools, charter schools have had the same impact. It came as a surprise to us. We knew the virus was happening, and we had received a letter from the Department of Health back on February 5th discussing the possibility of this pandemic. So a lot of our schools had an opportunity to be proactive and start planning ahead of time in case there was a pandemic and there were school closures. But at the end of the day, Loman, when this actually took place on March 13th and schools were told to shut down at a moment's notice, it caught everybody by surprise. And to be honest with you, the most prepared schools out of everybody, all the school agencies in the state, were the cyber charter schools that have had experience for 20 years in Pennsylvania in educating students online. And they currently already serve approximately 37,000 students with a wide range of educational needs in every county of the state, and they do that virtually. So for them, it was less of an impact, but for the brick-and-mortar charter schools, it was an uphill climb, to say the least.
In terms of what the governor and the legislature have been requiring, how are you proceeding? How are you continuing to provide some amount of continuity of education to students?
We are obviously following all the guidelines the Department of Education has posted. And I will say that the department has done a really good job at communicating with us, specifically with the Pennsylvania Coalition of Public Charter Schools, and trying to communicate with charter leaders as well. As a matter of fact, Secretary Rivera is going to be setting up phone calls with every single charter leader, group phone calls, obviously, in the coming weeks. So we're very appreciative of that. But it was, at first, it was unclear what the guidelines were supposed to mean, and it was confusing, to say the least. But little by little, we were able to go through all the guidelines and get answers and understand that every school in Pennsylvania is supposed to provide continuity of education online. And schools have done that in a variety of manners. For the charter schools, we were able to connect them with a lot of the brick-and-mortar charter schools with the cyber charter schools in the state. The cybers, even prior to the closures, made the offer to the Department of Education that they were available to be able to do webinars or whatever it took to bring schools up to speed on what they could do in order to become effective and efficiently go online to serve their students online. And a lot of the brick-and-mortar charter schools took them up on that offer. So PA Distance Learning, for instance, which is a cyber school that's located in Pittsburgh, they held a teleconference right in the first week, I believe, that we had school closures with their colleagues from across Pennsylvania to discuss distance school counseling. And they were able to share best practices, strategies, and tools with their colleagues. Unfortunately, only a few private schools and the brick-and-mortar charter schools took them up on it. As far as the school district go, I don't believe any school districts have actually sat down with the cyber schools to learn from them.
Why would that be? It would seem to me that the cyber charter schools would have been in a uniquely advantageous position here because they've already been down this path. They already have the curriculum. They already have the technology. Mm-hmm. Is this just part of what is a general bias against any non-public brick-and-mortar school by the Wolf administration?
Yeah, I think so. As you know really well, there is a lot of the Wolf administration has proposed $280 million in cuts to charter schools throughout the state. That is part of his budget proposal that he announced in February. And obviously, there's a lot of animosity between the school districts towards charter schools because they cling to the tuition, right? The money in Pennsylvania follows the student. So the tuition for charter school students, a portion of the tuition follows the student to a charter school. And the school districts don't want to accept the fact that this is taxpayer dollars. This is not their money. This is, if a parent chooses to take their child to a charter school, then the money should, by law, follow the student. And in Pennsylvania, it's only approximately 75% of the tuition that follows the student. So the school districts still get to keep about 25% to be able to right size. But because of that, because of the money situation, there is a lot of animosity.
We are talking with Anna Myers, who is executive director of the Pennsylvania Coalition of Public Charter Schools. And Anna, all this, we're all in this together. It seems to work whenever the education establishment in Pennsylvania gets what it wants. When it doesn't, we're not necessarily all in this together. Mm-hmm. And I know that before the whole coronavirus pandemic hit, there, as you alluded to briefly, there were efforts by the Wolf administration to cut funding and make changes to public charter schools and to cyber charter schools. Can you fill us in as to where those bills, where those legislative efforts might stand at the moment?
There was a lot of talk, right, all the way up until the pandemic in March. And Governor Wolf was, I think that's one of his highest priorities, was to cut funding to charter schools, both brick-and-mortar and cyber charter schools. We haven't heard much about this ever since the pandemic. And, you know, and in talking with our lobbyists and in talking with legislators, I think they're solely focused right now on the pandemic and making sure that Pennsylvania as a whole is being served properly and that things are moving along in the state. So my hope, Loman, is that this is an issue that's going to be tabled and that it's not going to come up during budget discussions, because I really think that any controversial policy discussions at this point of this magnitude, because it would impact over 140,000 students, public students in the state negatively, especially minority students and low economic income students, I think that needs to be tabled. There is no room for that discussion currently.
We are about to go into the budget process. after we get through that, and maybe not even after that, because there's a possibility we could go into an extended budget stalemate here. That, of course, a topic for another day. But as we head into the late summer, into August, mid to late August, September, the question becomes, what happens with our school students? Pedro Rivera, the state education secretary, first said he doubted that students would go back to school in August, September. Then later he switched courses and said he thought they would. So where does this leave the public charter schools, Anna, and the cyber schools? Any plans or preparations underway for how the upcoming school year will turn out?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, we offer guidelines from the Department of Education in Pennsylvania, and the sooner those guidelines come to us, the better off we're all going to be. But nevertheless, public cyber charter schools will continue to operate almost as normally, with the exceptions of in-person activities, if we continue to be closed in the fall. And public cyber charter schools will also have the capacity for more students if necessary. And that's something that we're going to make clear to the legislature and to the Department of Education. As far as the brick-and-mortar charter schools go, we're currently working on three different scenarios, Loman. So one would be returning in the fall with all students and with smaller groups of students. A delayed start, which we would continue with planned instruction, is another option. And number three would be returning in the fall with the potential of a second wave occurring. Really, we can't implement anything until we get word from the Department of Education on what the guidance is going to be for the fall.
Do you foresee an upswing in enrollment for the cybers?
Yeah, absolutely. We have already seen a surge in the cyber enrollment. I took an informal survey of our cyber, the 14 cyber charter schools in the state. 11 of them responded to us, and between March 13th and April 20th, they saw approximately 1,500 students throughout the state enroll in cyber charter school. And that's a significant amount. So yes, I would assume that if the closures are to continue, that more and more parents will be looking for cyber charter schools, because after all, they know what they're doing online. And I think this has been an opportunity, Loman, for them to show the state, to show lawmakers, and to actually show the population of the state that the claims that are made against them from the school districts and from the special interest groups, they are false. I mean, these schools have been able to continue to operate. If you go on social media and you take a look at the comments from the parents, and which I hear from parents on a daily basis, these parents are happy. They are content with the way their schools, both the brick and mortar and cyber charter schools, are handling the pandemic. You cannot say the same for the school district families. When I was speaking at the hearing, the Senate Education Committee hearing last week, I could see the comments on Facebook. And the comments from the families throughout the state that attend the school district they are outraged with how some of their schools are handling the pandemic.
We have been talking again with Anna Myers, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Coalition of Public Charter Schools. Anna, if we have listeners who would like to learn more about your organization, get more information on public charter schools, cyber schools, where can they go on the web to get that information?
They can contact us at www.pacharters.org. So again, pacharters.org.
pacharters.org. Anna Myers from the Pennsylvania Coalition of Public Charter Schools. Anna, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Loman.
The Pennsylvania Turnpike suffered from financial problems before the coronavirus crisis. The sudden drop in toll-paying traffic has made those problems even worse. Here with details are Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi with an Allegheny Institute report. Eric?
Hello, and welcome to the Allegheny Institute report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is the Executive Director of the Allegheny Institute, Frank Gamrat. Frank, how are you today?
I'm doing fine in this lockdown crazy world.
It's been something. I'm sure on behalf of the entire Allegheny Institute, we would like to make sure that our listeners are doing well. We wish them all the best. Interestingly, Frank, this is typically the time of year we talk about people starting to hit the road, road trips, vacations.
Yep, summer's starting.
Summer is starting, and one of those roads that they might travel is the Pennsylvania Turnpike. And as we've started to look at the impacts of the coronavirus on state and local government, Frank, there is an interesting financial arrangement about the Turnpike that probably would think start to talk about like a domino effect or unintended consequences when you have the virus that shuts something down or restricts its use. Could you give our listeners some detail on the background of that?
Absolutely. As most folks may actually not be aware, the turnpike has, under Act 44 of 2007, was given the mandate that they need to give a payment to PennDOT. The current number is $450 million per year. Of that money, PennDOT is to take $400 million of it and give it to mass transit agencies around the state, and the other $50 million goes to other projects. In Act 44 of 2007, that number was a lot larger. The payment was actually $900 million a year for the first couple years, but it was predicated on the state, the Governor Rendell at the time, to toll Interstate 80. As most people know, that is a federally owned road and is illegal to toll it unless you're using the tolls to plow back into that road. It was not to be used for anything else, so the feds denied it. Well, the turnpike was still stuck with this payment, so in 2010, that payment was lowered to $450 million, which it was to be that way until 2057, 50 years from 2007. And then in 2023 or 2024, that payment goes down, I believe, $50 million for the duration. So anyway, to pay this thing, the turnpike has to borrow money from it. In 2010, for example, mainline bonds were $5 point some billion, and by 2019 it was $12 point something billion. And so it's certainly ballooned their debt payments. And of course, now that we have the coronavirus and people aren't on the roads, the turnpike went to the state and said, hey, I know we owe you a July payment of $112 million as part of the $450 million payment, but can we get a pass on that? Can we skip it for now? Not really skip it, but delay that payment until we get the money. And they were granted permission to do so. You know, that certainly may not bode well for future payments.
One of the things that you are looking at is the division of passenger vehicles and then commercial traffic, because in this period of shutdown, lockdown, where you stay at home, you know, red zone, then we'll start to loosen up here in southwestern Pennsylvania in yellow, and then eventually we get to green. That's going to impact the type of vehicles that are traveling out there, because you obviously have travel for necessity, travel to make sure you're checking in on relatives, making sure that they're okay, going out for necessities. But can you give our listeners a breakdown? So what's been the recent couple years of Class 1 passenger vehicles, and then the commercial traffic that, and maybe what the usage has been during this time period?
Absolutely. When the Turnpike Commission went to the state and said, hey, we'd like to delay or get a little bit of a break on this July $112 million payment to PennDOT, they cited sharply declining activity on the turnpike. Now, as you mentioned, the state went into lockdown mode mid-March, where the governor declared all of the counties in the red zone. And only essential travel was to take place. Only essential workers were to take place. And then, of course, at the beginning of May, the northern counties went into the yellow phase. Southwestern Pennsylvania went into the yellow phase the next week. And then the southeast PA is still red. I think that's supposed to expire June 4th or so. And so they're still in red. But the question that we wanted to ask is, well, what has been the decrease to traffic counts? Now, we divide, like you said, divide into two pieces: Class 1, which is passenger vehicles, and then business or commercial vehicles, or Class 2 through 9. So in Class 1, we looked at the data that was available, and all this is available on Turnpike's website. In January, we noticed about 10 million cars using the Turnpike, and then in February, again, it was a little bit more. It was around 9 million, a little lower than January. And so I looked at the change in 2020 over 2019, and I noticed that traffic had picked up a little bit in the first 2 months of the year. So taking that increase of 3%, the average is 3% increase, we decided, okay, let's look at what could be seen as traffic for March, April, May, and June, and try to get some kind of a guesstimate as to what traffic would have been absent the lockdown, and then try to estimate what we think is going to happen. And look, if you want the details, the policy brief will be available online. There's a lot of numbers in there, but we're estimating probably about 40% usage of passenger vehicles, and that is the turnpike's about 40% as busy as it used to be. Now, in that vein, one of the things that we noticed, and if you're not familiar with the turnpike, it runs mostly on the southern part of the state, that it runs from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh. About 50% of passenger vehicles of cars run through the Philadelphia area, what they call District 4. So 50% of those cars, so if there's 10 million cars in the month of January, 5 million of them traveled through Philadelphia. They're the heaviestly impacted counties in this virus. They're still locked down. So you could probably have maybe even a larger segment of that those cars off the road. So when we looked at the estimates for those 4 months, Class 1 loss in revenues is about $124.17 million just for those 4 months. We did the same thing with commercial vehicles. And now with commercial vehicles, we estimated that the drop in usage is probably only going to be about 20% drop because supplies still need to be delivered. Online retailers were still heavily in use. But what we did notice was that, okay, there's no car sales, so car carriers are off the road. There's no furniture sales. There's a lot of things that were not, you know, manufacturing was not allowed to be open, so you know, raw materials and finished goods to and from. So we estimate the drop in commercial traffic to be a little bit less, like 20%, so about 80% full. And again, only about a third of truck traffic goes through the Philadelphia exits, and we estimated that the loss in commercial revenues would be about $34 million. So when you put the two together, we're talking about $158 million or so in losses to the turnpike from cars not using that highway. And again, the data that we're using all comes from the turnpike's website, and what they had done was given us an average revenue per vehicle transaction, and we just took that number and multiplied it by what we think the change in traffic will be in those cars and commercial vehicles, and tried to give this estimate, and you know, we came out with $158 million. So then we circle back to this notion of, okay, what does that mean? And what it means is the turnpike is going to have a harder time coming up with their payment to PennDOT. Again, making those debt payments for debt already incurred is going to be a tremendous undertaking. I mean, you're talking $750 million in debt payments a year related to debt on mainline turnpike tolls, which was used for this whole PennDOT reimbursement scheme. So they're going to be in a hard case to come up with that money. And what we're advocating is for the legislature to lessen that burden on the turnpike. I mean, this is getting to be a little burdensome with all this debt. And the turnpike eventually is going to have to use all money to pay for the tolls and won't have as much money left over for basic construction or maintenance.
Frank, interesting stuff as always, and our listeners can visit our website, which is www.alleghenyinstitute.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. For Frank Gamrat, this is Eric Montardi, and this has been the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
Regulatory restrictions on the medical community were loosened when COVID-19 surged. On this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary, Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity, PA, says those changes were good and should remain in place.
Several months ago, we talked about health care policies and what Pennsylvania could and should do to help patients and providers. More doctors and nurses have been able to care for more patients due to Governor Wolf's loosening of controls over telemedicine and occupational licenses. Empowering these professionals to do what they know best, help people live safer and healthier lives, is what each policymaker, both in Harrisburg and Washington, should be focused on. We are asking for healthcare professionals to have more flexibility in providing the care as they and their patients see fit. 83% of Americans want this too, according to a poll conducted by YouGov and AFP in mid-April. Here in Harrisburg, there's been some movement, as I just mentioned, but not near enough. Overly burdensome regulations and licensing restrictions have been lifted during COVID-19. Now, the legislature needs to act and make these changes permanent. The number of Department of State waivers of licensing requirements has shown that government has unnecessarily stood in the way of healthcare professionals providing what people need when they need it most. Doctors and nurses are the real heroes of this pandemic. So if they can practice with greater flexibility now, why not trust them to do so permanently? On March 18th, the Department of State issued a notice that Governor Wolf granted out-of-state practitioners the ability to treat PA patients through telemedicine services, but only during the emergency. Well, PA is one of only 8 states without a comprehensive structure governing telemedicine. What's the consequence? A limited provider option to treat Medicaid patients and greater costs to all patients. Telemedicine is proven to lower costs, as the overhead considerations of an in-office visit aren't realized. According to the Wall Street Journal, routine online consultations typically cost around $45. That compares with the $100 or more for an in-office visit, $160 for a visit to an urgent care clinic, and $750 or more at a hospital emergency room. What does that math generate? Telemedicine can reduce some costs by 90%. Senate Bill 857 passed the General Assembly with bipartisan support, but was vetoed by Governor Wolf on April 29th due to disagreements with the legislature on prescribing technicalities. Well, there's another vehicle that has bipartisan support that doesn't co-mingle the prescribing issue, House Bill 15. The House Insurance Committee should act now to get this telemedicine bill on its way to the governor. When it comes to 2 glaring cases of inaction, Pennsylvania patients should look squarely at the House Professional Licensure Committee. Since 2013, yes, that's 7 years ago, advanced practice nurses and certified nurse anesthetists have fought for 2 policies that would enable them to better serve PA patients. We've seen the administration improve licensing flexibility, but only during the COVID-19 emergency. If there was ever a time for the legislature to send a message to our heroes, our frontline healthcare professionals, that we trust their education and training, it is now. Senate Bill 25 and House Bill 100 would give full practice authority to experienced nurse practitioners and immediately increase access to care, relieving the provider shortage PA has. Over 540,000 Pennsylvanians reside in communities that face a severe physician shortage. This does not have to be the case. Delaying now compromises our footing to deal with a potential second wave of the virus or any future public health threat. To find us on Facebook, search @PAAFP, and on Twitter by searching @AFP Pennsylvania. I'm Ashley Klingensmith, State Director with Americans for Prosperity.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 25 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WJSM-FM in Martinsburg, WJUN-AM in Mexico, along with WQZS-FM in Myersdale, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the cost of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.
Thank you.